Chapter 10. Tilly. The message had come with my breakfast, sealed in a green bordered envelope with a circle of plum wax, slipped beneath my plate of mango. The flourish was entirely that of the hotel, but the message was all Blair, typically Spartan in its efficiency and authoritarian in the way it marshaled both letter and meaning into lockstep obedience.
Tilly, John's a mess. No shooting. Ivanova over today. My place, 11 o'clock. BG.
I took the message to mean that Jack Wellington, only Blair called him John, had gotten worse, had progressed from feverish fatigue and green-tinted wooziness to actual incapacitation. I assumed constant vomiting and diarrhea, and turned out to be correct. Jack was a 50-something London stage actor who longed to segue into American film. I think Blair cast him in our movie because he needed an older, attractive-looking Brit to play the part of the man who unwittingly delivers his family and himself unto a pride of hungry lions. It was brilliant casting. Jack delivered every scene with a compelling subtext of desperation. He had the look, sound, and feel of someone for whom time was running out, a condition that, on screen, was believably inspired by the breath of a 200-pound lion, and not simply poor theater reviews in the London Times. Unfortunately, Jack showed up in Mombasa with a nasty flu and a case of viral meningitis. While his condition certainly added to his natural air of desperation, it also took him out of commission. He soldiered on for the first couple of days. Blair found a way to turn the situation to his advantage by shooting the death by lion scenes before the safari camping scenes, because Jack just looked so awful. But eventually, the virus took Jack beyond even cinematic death, and we had to wait for him to recover. Blair took the disruption personally, of course, and never again used Jack Wellington, whose swan song before retiring was as the high school principal in a London stage production of Grease. But for as much as it vexed Blair, Jack's illness ended up playing to my advantage. The delay allowed for some additional days in Kenya, which I was growing to like very much, with its colors and tradition and its song. Among many other things, like browsing the open-air markets of Kongowea for spices and a beautiful yellow sari that is still in my closet after 70 years, or touring the teeming North Shore and its purlieus in a rickety boda boda with my very excellent guide, Cahill, who taught me how to chaffer with vendors and introduced me to authentic Tarab music, and then proposed marriage when I tried to pay him for the day. I owe to Jack Wellington's incapacity a hot air balloon ride that I have never forgotten. As the sun set over the acacia-dotted plains of the Masai Mara, loping clusters of giraffe, herds of antelope, and blue wildebeest and elephant, and vast flaming formations of African cranes, all slipping in and out of our quiet bulbous shadow. It might have been the shadow of a head, peering down into the cradle of humanity. It was like floating over an ancient dream that we all recognize in the marrow of our unconscious. But Jack's illness also meant that I finally had Blair's attention on script work. The hiatus allowed the better part of 2 full days for us to get to the bottom of Colonel Elena Ivanova, which was a vast improvement over the scraps of attention she had been receiving in the evenings after a day of shooting and compulsive fretting over the dailies.
Tilly, John's a mess. No shooting. I've an over today. My place, 11 o'clock. B.G.
The message beneath my breakfast fruit had offered no directions to my place. I found Blair Gaines that morning like I had all the others before. It was like falling, really. Or slipping on ice hidden beneath a whisper-thin sheet of snow. It is the nature of a body to succumb to gravity. And so it was with me and my directors. It was a sound that they made, or a light that they shed, or a vibration that they hummed in their bones without even knowing. Or at least knowing without really knowing. They must have known something. How can a resonance so true, so perfectly tuned, go unnoticed? Like so many directors, Blair had a singularity of presence that gleamed and flickered in the dark. Like a beacon to lost and desperate sailors. Strange that it is the lost and desperate who are most likely to mistake warning for invitation. It is an irony so sick as to make one believe in a psychopathic God. But then, the notion that God has issues in abusing our trust has always been one close to my heart. In the words of Angus Mann, trust breeds its own betrayal, even in the heart of God. For a man with a reputation as a gritty, down-to-earth, working man's director, Blair Gaines knew how to luxuriate. I found him on a saffron lounge at the foot of an immaculately maintained lily-strewn pond. The lounge had been backed up against the trunk of an enormous waterberry tree, its lush canopy dappled with dense clumps of cream-colored flowers, its southern branches ballooning like a rich green cumulus raining petals out over the pond. There was something so striking, so indefinably emblematic in the sight of this man, caught in such languid repose beneath such a magnificent tree, that I had an impulse to paint him. I wanted to drop everything where I stood and tell my escort to find me an easel and canvas and some vibrant oils. The sky was a deep clot of cobalt, and the sun roared, shaking its fiery mane along its midday arc. The pond at Blair's feet was on a corner of acreage that surrounded the two-story villa he had rented for the duration of our stay in Kenya. The villa was owned and operated by the hotel in which the rest of us were staying, but safely ensconced on its own atoll, floating in indigo waters about an eighth of a mile offshore. It was one of maybe a dozen such islands, strung together in a tiny corporate archipelago that unwound gracefully into the Indian Ocean. Each island had a private dock and a motorboat that waved the company flag of red, green, and gold interlinked rings, a colorful Olympic-inspired chain on a field of white. On the ocean side of each island, safe from the prying eyes of the mainlanders, were deep crescents of soft white sand. I remember marveling to myself as I had stepped precariously from the water taxi up onto the dock, grabbing the strong, reedy black hand of the man who was there to greet me and show me the way, that Blair spent so much of his time on shore, meeting with us into the late evenings in the common courtyards and restaurants of the hotel, returning to his island only once everyone else had padded their pockets for a room key
and shuffled off to bed. I think, had it been me, I would never have left the island. I would have made everyone come to me. I would have made a point of holding court, even under a pretense of business, so that every evening was a generously spread, richly catered affair under the African moon, with music and good wine. It was that lovely. Blair, dressed only in faded blue trunks and an Outback safari hat, was busy hacking up the script with multicolored pens. If he was aware of our approach across the lawn, his demeanor betrayed nothing. My escort, dressed in a starched ochre uniform, his skin so black as to seem almost midnight blue as we stepped into the shade of the waterberry, announced my arrival with a slight genuflection, as though addressing a king.
Miss Tilly John, sir. Thank you, Sanjata.
Blair made an angry, slashing circle around 8 lines of dialogue. He gave me a darting glance without really looking up.
Sanjata, bring us another chair if you would, mate. Yes, sir. And, oh, another one of these.
His hand dropped behind the lounge and brought up a large empty glass wrapped in white cloth.
Yes, Mr. Gaines. And may I bring one for Miss Tilly John? Yes, right.
Blair answered for me before I could respond. With another slash across the page, he shook his head and smiled a little, apparently liking the sound of my new name.
By all means, bring one for Miss Tilly John. Yes, sir.
And Sanjata was gone, striding across the lawn up toward the villa.
It's got a certain charm, don't you think?
What?
Tilly John. Maybe you should keep it.
He looked up at me for the first time. He was smiling, but I knew him well enough in just a few weeks to know that this was a facade. That he was not really in a smiling mood. The pleasantry was quickly melting in the heat of his agitation and the derailment caused by illness and British frailty.
Maybe I will keep it, I said.
Then, giving an obvious glance at the script on his lap,
are you going to keep any of this script, or are we starting from scratch?
Bloody thing. I should start over. I should start from page 1 and write the goddamn thing myself.
He capped his pen and stood up abruptly, dropping the notebook on the lounge.
Have a seat, Tilly John. Back in a tick.
He dropped his hat on top of the notebook and, with one forward step, he dove cleanly into the pond, submerging beneath the lilies and the fallen waterberry blossoms, and did not resurface until he had reached the far bank. Most of Blair's working man's director reputation really came from a general aversion to displaying his great wealth in public, which, I believe, was his genuine antipathy to attention and not the coy diamonds and denim stubble grooming ill-kempt affectation that the glitterati so commonly adopt in order to stand out in a crowd. When he was not on a movie set, Blair genuinely preferred to blend into his surroundings, to become the common man, or, at least, the extraordinary man unseen. He was not a man of scandal, and he was remarkably successful in avoiding the tabloids. As much as anything, it was the Vanity Fair piece that came out after Obsidian Iris swept the Oscars that cemented Blair's persona as the reluctant, unassuming cinematic genius. It was his open disdain for Hollywood, if not all of America, and his hobby building sailboats, and the photos of him and his golden-haired sons streaked with sweat and mud, and swinging axes to clear some of his Australian homestead,
They, Vanity Fair, were aiming for the anti-establishment appeal, and they hit the bullseye. The irony was that when Blair was working, when he did the very thing that made Vanity Fair care about him in the first place, there was nothing remotely common about him, and he made absolutely no effort to blend into the background. Quite the contrary, Blair made it very clear who was in charge. He owned every aspect of the production, a point he would make if he had to mark, like a dog at a hydrant, every camera, every actor, and every square inch of set. He owned it all. It belonged to him. But, and here is really the point, while Blair wielded his professional dominion as an entitlement, it was an entitlement born not of wealth or fame, but of sheer talent and hard work and an egomaniacal hubris of epic proportions. He was in charge because he cared more than anyone else, and because no one else, the writers, the actors, the technicians, the producers, the animal trainers, no one could do their jobs as well as Blair could do their jobs. "You a swimmer?" he asked, hoisting his body out of the pond. His suit clung to his body, and I averted my eyes from the topography of his groin out of a sense of decency and decorum I did not really possess in those days. "I'm from Ohio," I said, a little too self-evidently. He toweled his mop of tawny hair that hung in wet ringlets and tendrils down to his shoulders. He stuffed his hat back on his head and set the towel to work over the rest of him, which was fit and muscular in the way of older men who used to be fit and muscular.
"Thought you were from L.A.
"I grew up in Ohio."
"Now shit. You know Angus is from..."
"Yeah, I know."
"So? What? No lakes in Ohio? Rivers? No pools?"
"Well, yeah, but not where I lived. No ocean, anyway."
"Pity. Nothing like a swim."
"Well, I did more reading than swimming. I didn't grow up down under."
"Oh, God. Please don't call it that."
"Really? Why?"
"Just don't. I fucking hate that."
"Okay."
"Australia. Australia."
He flattened out the middle syllable just to be obnoxious.
"Right?"
"Yeah, whatever. I didn't grow up in Australia."
"It's a tourist phrase. I hate tourists."
I opened my arms at the Indian Ocean, taking it in as it broke in soft surges over the tiny island.
"Aren't we tourists?"
"No."
"Then what are we?"
"I'm an earthling, Tillijohn. What are you?"
He swung the towel over his shoulders, leathered with old sun.
"Choose to be a stranger if you want, but I claim the whole bloody planet. I've got to piss and grab some clothes. Beckon a tick."
He pointed at the script on the lounge as he strode past me up the lawn.
"Stop reading. Anything in red is new Ivanova. You haven't seen it yet. Anything slashed through in black is old Ivanova that's already gone. Anything slashed through in green is current Ivanova that I hate and still needs to be cut and replaced."
Sunjata was making his way back down from the villa, pulling a bright yellow lounge behind him. Two dark women in matching uniforms followed, watching their steps as the ground sloped away toward the magnificent Waterbury and me beneath it. I later learned these to be Sunjata's daughters, Kainda and Urena. One carried a small wicker table, the other a pitcher and glass. Blair gripped Sunjata vigorously by the shoulder as they passed. Sunjata laughed, as though in some secret conspiracy, showing his large, yellowed teeth.
"Thank you, Mr. Gaines. Thank you, sir."
And the women laughed with him.
We worked through the rest of the morning and into the late afternoon. Sunjata and his daughters plied us with chilled mango juice and freshly roasted meats, Nyama Choma, from a fired spit up near the villa. We used our fingers and our teeth to pick the flesh clean from charred bamboo skewers. My lips burned in spicy barbecue that stained the skin. I have kept as a memento from the Lion Tree production the draft script that we worked from that afternoon. Many of the pages are stuck together. On most are clear fingerprints, Blair's and mine cast in red, as though evidence of some awful violence. I could say that we were collaborating on revising the script, reshaping Colonel Ivanova into someone coherent and believable. I have said that, in fact. Many times I have told the story of us beneath the Waterbury in Mombasa, as if it had been an exercise of collaboration. But it was nothing of the kind. It was an exercise in obeisance. It was an exercise of reflection and amplification. Blair did not need my creative input as much as he needed to hear his words on someone else's tongue. Had we been painting, I would have been holding the easel. And the irony? They were not his words at all. "Where did you last see her?" I remember speaking coldly to Blair, who, pacing back and forth between the tree and the pond, was reading the part of Lieutenant Alan Miller. I remember that it was difficult for me to find Ivanova in those surroundings, so relaxed and lush. My words were like reluctant stones cast into a garden. "What was her name? Jules? What was it? Where did you last see Jules?"
"I don't care for your tone, Colonel."
"Good. Where did you see her last, Lieutenant?"
"Can you spare one of those snappers?"
"Answer my question."
"Ocean Park, at home, 4 days before we left. That's where I last saw her. Can I have a goddamn snapper now?"
I looked at him from the yellow pocket of my lounge, and he at me. For here, Ivanova is to extract what her prisoner desires from a pocket in her uniform.
"She wasn't at the launch?" I asked.
"She never came to the launches. Never saw the point. Anyway, she was sick."
"Sick with what?"
"Just didn't feel good. Is the army going to allow me an opportunity to grieve the loss of my wife?"
"Grieve all you want, Lieutenant. Just answer my questions."
"I don't understand why this is happening. I did not hurt her."
Blair spoke the words in a tone that was half anguish, half anger. I can admit now that I was impressed.
"She's not hurt, Lieutenant. She's dead."
"I didn't kill her. What makes you think I did? I was..."
"You were what? Here?"
"Yes. With you. Here. Jesus, El. It happened 10 months ago. How could I?"
"That's Colonel Ivanova, Lieutenant. I won't..."
Blair slapped the script against his bare leg in exasperation.
"Damn it, Tilly."
"What? What?"
"No. No, you tell me what."
Still too fast?
Yes, still too bloody fast.
His words were sharp. His face was pinched and red with impatience, his lips still stained with hours-old sauce.
What exactly is your hurry?
I thought...
Were you hoping to use the day to tan your legs? Is that it?
What?
I was unaccustomed at that age of being self-conscious about my body. Quite the contrary, as more than a few shameless photographic misadventures will attest. And yet, Blair's remark made me feel like a child. Like I had been caught trying on my mother's lipstick. Caught not by my mother, who might have understood, but by my father. This is not to suggest that I was a particularly provocative dresser in Africa. I was not. Lots of khaki and denim and hiking shoes and socks that kept the grass flies off my ankles. The crew more than once accused me of modeling for a safari wear catalog. On the day of my script work with Blair, I wore one of three African sarongs that I had purchased at a market in Tozeur. On top, I wore a peridot tee with high-cut sleeves. Beneath the sarong and the tee, I wore a bathing suit. Two pieces made of white lycra. Lying about at the hotel pool, or on a pile of white sand working on my lines, had indeed been on my agenda after we were through that afternoon, if only to take advantage of a rare day that we were not bouncing along in jeeps and trucks over dusty savannas. As my day with Blair wore on, the sarong had become increasingly twisted in the deep cushion of the lounge, causing me to have to stand up and retie and press out the damp wrinkles with the flat of my hands. Eventually, the sarong was such a nuisance that I took it off entirely. I thought nothing of it, certainly with Blair having set the tone for the afternoon in his own trunks.
My legs?
No.
Blair, slow down, Tilly John. Slow down. Ivanova is going to slowly crush this guy with her questions. See? He's the one in a hurry, see? She's like...
He took off his hat and ran his fingers through his hair, staring hard at the ground, forcing himself to calm down, thinking.
You know, in old bad horror films, how the victim is running like mad. Like crazy. Like bloody crazy to get away from Frankenstein or the zombies or whatever.
Night of the Living Dead?
Yes, right. I mean, running all out, sweating and panting and wheezing. They've been running so hard. And the zombie takes his bloody time. The zombie is out for a fucking stroll, Tilly.
Yeah. Okay.
The zombie is relentless, Tilly. He's gonna get the guy. It's inevitable. There's no need to be in a hurry. That's horror at its most excruciating. Slow, crushing inevitability. She's gonna get him and she's not in a hurry about it. Okay?
Okay. I'll slow it down.
Let's pick it up with, she's not hurt.
I closed my eyes, recentered, took a breath, and tried again. She's not hurt, Lieutenant. She's dead.
I didn't kill her. What makes you think I did?
You were what? Here?
Yes, with you. Here. Jesus, El, it happened 10 months ago. How could I?
Here, I actually lit a cigarette, just as Ivanova is supposed to light a snapper, the distant future's self-mentholating, entirely ingestible answer to Virginia Slims. I lit it more because I needed it than because it worked with the script. I kept the smoke roiling in soft pillows over my tongue, like some vaporous serpent choosing not to pass my lips. Blair seemed momentarily satisfied that it had slowed down the dialogue. "That's Colonel Ivanova, Lieutenant. I won't say it again." A long exhale as the serpent left its fleshly lair. "It takes over 10 months to get a relay. You knew that, didn't you? Didn't you?" Another pull on the snapper. "Of course you did. We're a long way out there, Lieutenant, even for a beam of light." I counted to 5 in my mind before I continued. "But now I'm getting a steady stream of information. 3-4 updates every 12 hours. Who knows what they're doing now? All those Unix MPs, they're onto something else, for sure. Like little sleuthing carpenter ants. It's always something." Another pull on the snapper. Another cuckolding of smoke. "But 10 months ago, they were speaking your name every other breath. And every other breath, they scribbled out a message, stuck it in a photon bottle, and tossed it into the ocean. Now, after all this time, those little bottles of light are beginning to wash up on shore. It's like looking at old starlight, really. We're looking at history. But I'm learning a lot about you now, Lieutenant. An awful lot." "God damn it, Tilly. What do I have to do?" I fell back into the lounge and looked at him, dismayed. There was no call for this degree of agitation. I was not racing through the lines. I was not stepping on his words. I was acting, at least, the best I could given the informality of the setting, and even so, this was not supposed to be an audition. I had the part. This was not a second or third take on a scene that was not working because the dialogue was too fast. The exercise was supposed to be conceptual, more about the character on the page than my ability to bring her to life. And yet, suddenly, it seemed all about me and only about me. The disappointment was everywhere on his face. I consulted my cigarette for a moment and then looked at him again. "Ivanova the zombie?"
"Yes."
"But she's not a zombie, Blair, and this..."
"Tilly."
"Blair? This is not a horror movie."
"Oh, Christ."
He took another breath before continuing, massaging the back of his neck with his free hand.
"I know it's not a bloody horror movie. I was making a point."
"And so am I. This is a love story, Blair. A love story. Ivanova is a woman in love. Everything else is an act. A cover. A fraud, Blair. She is duty-bound to learn what she can of Lieutenant Miller, her lover, but she knows that everything she learns about him will separate that love from her own soul, leaving her to die just like Miller's wife was left to die on Earth. If Miller is tortured by the questions, Ivanova is doubly tortured by the answers. She's not a zombie, and if she is at all robotic or cold in her method, then she has to be at least a little unconvincing, because that is not what she really feels." The great Blair Gaines looked at me in a silent, purple-veined fury. The script in his hand was rolled into a tight scepter, and for a moment I imagined him hitting me with it. He dropped the script in the grass at the base of the tree and knocked off his hat. Where the hat had been was a scarlet band around his forehead, his yellow hair matted with sweat against his skin. He began to unbutton his shirt, his eyes never leaving me.
"Don't you ever condescend to me about this script, Tilly John. I handpicked this material. I've read it 4 dozen times. I know exactly what it's about. Why do you think I've made such an effort to use the original dialogue?"
He threw his shirt on the ground and started to roar at me.
"Why do you think I have hecked this script to pieces? Do you think I'm out here yanking my picker?"
"No."
"No. You're goddamn right, no. I know what I'm doing. And if I say you've got the wrong tone, then you've got the wrong bloody tone. I've asked you to act, and you're doing a piss poor job of it. I don't need you to philosophize about Ivanova's motivations. I need you to be convincing. One Sundance nomination in a year of slim pickings doesn't make you an actress. So get over yourself. I need you to deliver the performance of your pathetic career. Do you understand me? You can either work with me, or you can walk the hell right out of my picture."
Blair turned his back on me abruptly and stripped off his shorts. I watched him, mesmerized by his effrontery, as one watches an unpredictable beast that has come too close. He turned for a moment to look at me, his face an angry precipice of indecision, as though he was not yet done, an acknowledgement that there was still plenty of meat on the carcass. Then, in as graceful a dive as I had ever seen, he slipped naked beneath the surface of the pond. He was as beautiful and as harmless natant as he was savage on land. If I had had any idea of who I was at that age, I mean who I really was, or of what sickness fueled the great engines of my self-identity, then I would have been gone. From the lounge, from the tree, from the island, by the time Blair reemerged from beneath the floating carpet of waterberry blossoms. But, incredibly, I did not know these things back then. And so I stayed, waiting patiently for him to finish me off. When Blair had again hoisted himself from the water, slick and dappled in wet white blossoms, he summoned Sunjata for a towel. He made no effort to cover himself, nor apologize for the rudeness that had preceded his swim.
"God damn, Jack Willington," he said,
flicking petals from his shoulders and arms.
"He's always been a bit of a puss. Brits are always getting sick. Little hothouse flowers, the lot of them. We could have made a lot of progress today. We could have been very productive."
It was as close to an apology as I would ever get. I knew he was telling me that his anger had more to do with expensive downtime, an idle crew, and the loss of a director's momentum than it did with the way I was reading or interpreting the part of Elena Ivanova. I knew, or I should say that I thought at the time, that it was the sudden change of pace, from filming safaris and wild animals to suddenly backyard play acting, that was under his skin. I knew this, though I did not feel it. What I felt, quite powerfully, was the meaning buried in the air between his words, that the great Blair Gaines did not view anything that we had been doing that afternoon as productive. I felt that I was a disappointment and a colossal waste of his time. Blair dried himself, redressed, and we began again. working through the Ivanova scenes in order. His composure had mostly returned, although I remember being regularly concerned that he would lay into me again. But the fulminations did not return, largely because I worked very hard to gauge Blair's emotions and avoid offense. On the occasions that we worked on new scenes, those with no counterpart in the text of the original story, I found myself fighting to keep my opinions to myself. I was aware that a movie is never a book, that these are two distinct art forms that can mimic one another but never occupy the same space in the world. So I understood the need to use the story as a starting point and to fill it out cinematically. Just the same, I did not like many of the scenes Blair had added, scenes in which Lieutenant Miller attempts to escape, only to be thwarted by Ivanova. Scenes in which Ivanova takes an obvious pleasure in the psychological cat and mouse by rather cruelly flirting with Miller. Backstory scenes in which Ivanova is a sexual aggressor, abusing her power, and Miller, a dutiful lieutenant, out of his depth in the spell of this woman. While these added scenes improved the film, they did not resonate with the underlying story. A screenplay adapted from an original work to be successful. No, to be true, is like adapting a musical composition into a different key or for another instrument. The notes can be faster or slower or higher or lower, played on a banjo or by a 50-piece orchestra, but it has to be somewhere deep inside where the rhythm woos the melody. It has to be the same song. As Blair and I worked through his improvements, I found myself oddly defensive of the text Angus Mann had written. I took offense on his behalf, as though I cared as much for the man as I did his little story. My last encounter with Angus had been that morning, in line at the hotel sundry shop. We stood one behind the other for an interminable 5 minutes as the clerk struggled to install a new roll of paper in her adding machine. We did not speak to each other once, as though we were complete strangers. Certainly the clerk would never have guessed that we had spent all of the previous day in the other's company, much of it in the back seat of a Jeep, and much of it fighting over semantics and rolling our eyes at each other's perspective on everything from film to literature to politics to the social scourge of politically correct speech. I feared that I might eventually come to associate the magnificent Savannah with Angus's sententious lectures. By the time the clerk had resolved to use a pencil, I had resolved to allow Angus to nurse his isolationist tendencies as long as possible. I was glad not to talk with him. And yet, there I was later in the same day, feeling the urge to protect his creation, to protect Angus from a process that, from his perspective, was an assault to something true. But in deference to my director, whom I did not wish to anger any further, I suppressed these dissonant feelings as quickly as they arose. Mottled by distant clouds, the sun darkened and sank into a horizon of deepening blue, flecked and streaked with ginger. The insects came in their vespertine clouds to reclaim the island, and we moved inside. Sunjata and his daughters collected the detritus of our afternoon and cooked us dinner. Blair brushed aside my protestations against imposition as though he were swatting at insects. I stopped resisting and accepted his invitation to stay for dinner when I realized that my resistance was irritating him. That my resistance was actually perfunctory escaped us both. We ate in high-backed, velvet-cushioned chairs at a square wooden table in the center of a screened veranda. Kainda lit torches around the villa, and the giant waterberry loomed in the dusk, as an imposing shadow that seemed to shift and dance with the flame. The aroma of fire-roasted meats was everywhere, mingling with the smell of baked earth and brine. Urena brought us wine and fresh water, while Sunjata prepared a feast of more Nyama Choma, this time served with Sukuma Wiki, a mixture of local greens, and ugali, a stiff porridge of maize flour, served in large flat bricks eaten by breaking off pieces and using them like crude utensils to scoop up the meat. It was easily the best, most deeply satisfying meal I had had in Africa. When we had finished, Sunjata and his daughters cleared the table and poured us an African dessert wine that was too heavy and sweet to drink, except in small sips, but which quickly became more agreeable. The insects and the ocean serenaded from the darkness beyond the torches, and we drank and talked into the evening. We spoke mostly of the Lion Tree and of the challenges that Blair knew were coming up in the production. He was having some trouble with two executive producers who had had a falling out over another picture. One of the executive producers was threatening to pull out of the Lion Tree unless he got satisfaction. Blair was playing mediator, a role he loathed. He also alluded to what would become the insurmountable problem with the scriptwriters, suggesting that it had been a mistake to keep them on. If at that time Blair was already thinking of replacing them with Angus, he did not let on. We also talked of some of his other films, including Obsidian Iris, to which I confessed I had a deep and emotional allegiance when I was in college. He dished dirt about Russell Crowe, a stumpy and immature hothead, and Judi Dench, ridiculously provincial for someone of her stature, and Kate Winslet, a bit weepy and unpredictable on the set. Of Adrian Brody, he said, "That little prig seemed to think my movie was a workshop in extemporaneous acting. One minute, I'm filming The Confession of a Murderous Madman, and the next I'm watching Whose Line Is It Anyway?" We agreed that the success of the film was a testament to Blair's unique ability to manage difficult talent. As I listened, I hoped, although not openly, that I was, as of that afternoon, on his list of difficult talent. It bothered me not at all that he might see me as insufferably difficult, as long as he also saw this as the price of my abilities. Shortly after the wine was gone, Blair leaned back in his chair and looked at me with both of his hands in front of him, flat on the wooden table.
"Can you spare one of those snappers?"
I laughed in mid-reach for the still empty bottle of wine. "Answer my question," I said, mockingly stern and pointing at him.
"Ocean Park, at home, 4 days before we left. That's where I last saw her. Now give me a bloody goddamn snapper."
We both roared at what was surely a release of bottled tension from the incivility of the afternoon. I fished my purse out from beneath my chair and extracted two cigarettes. I lit one of them by the candle on the table and held it out for him, turning it around in my fingers so the lit end was pointed back at me. My coordination was not what I imagined. The cigarette dropped to the table in a spray of orange ash. Blair nearly lunged for it before it rolled from the table, and we both laughed harder than ever. Sunjata appeared with the telephone and whispered into Blair's ear. Blair deflated a little, then shook his head and sent Sunjata away. He smiled, and we smoked. I did not ask questions. My most enduring memory of that day was the fish tank. Blair had made a point of showing it to me as he gave me a tour of the villa. It was a saltwater tank,
large and rectangular, easily 6 feet long and 3 feet high, sitting on a shelf that glided on quiet rollers out of a well-lit notch carved into the wall. Pulling on the shelf brought the tank out into the room for easy cleaning and maintenance, although this had the effect of removing the water from direct lighting and made for poor viewing. Fully recessed, the tank was lit from all sides by multicolored beams that pulsed and faded and slowly oscillated, enchanting the enclosed seawater. The tank was thick with plant life. A dozen varieties of fish and eel wafted among the fat, rubbery leaves, in and out of shadow. I remember hating them. I remember revulsion at their alien bodies and their relentlessly undulating movement. The way they disappeared and reappeared, always the same and yet different. The way they traveled without moving. At a certain angle, if I bent my knees just so, I could see Blair's reflection in the glass as he tossed his clothes into an ornate wicker chair with flowered cushions. The fish seemed to swim through the room behind me, swim through the flowers on the cushions, swim through the back of the chair, swim over and under and through the bed as Blair pulled back the sheets and slipped inside. I remember thinking, as the lights went out, that I had never owned any fish when I was a little girl.